Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the April 18th, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week, it looks like some sort of industrial boiler room. There's a huge metal furnace, the doors open. And Donald Trump and his trade advisor, Peter Navarro, are smiling. They're in their suits, but they've got their jackets off and sleeves rolled up. They're just shoveling just piles of money into the furnace and grinning away. The headline is Playing with Fire, the High Cost of Trump and Navarro's Tariff Chaos. That comes up a number of times in today's issue, including the first main story. Trump dials down tariffs, but not for China. What happened? President Trump abruptly halted his plan to slap so-called reciprocal tariffs on dozens of countries this week, a stunning turnaround that came just 13 hours after the levies went into effect. Trump upended global trade last week by announcing he would institute a 10% tariff on most imports and place additional tariffs of up to 50% on 86 trading partners, including Vietnam, India, Bangladesh, Japan, and the European Union, over their unfair trade practices. Markets plunged in the days that followed, wiping out an estimated $10 trillion in value. But stocks surged after Trump announced on social media that he was pausing for 90 days the added tariffs on most countries, but keeping the 10% baseline. Citing openings for deal-making and rising concern about the economy, they were getting yippy, Trump said, a little bit afraid. A key exception was China, which saw its tariff rate hike to 125% after it retaliated with an 84% levy on U.S. imports. China will fight until the end if the U.S. side is bent on going down the wrong path, said China's Commerce Ministry. Trump's downshift followed mounting pushback from investors, business leaders, and trade associations who warned of looming economic devastation. J.P. Morgan economists put 60% odds on a recession this year. Former Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers said a tariff-induced downturn could cost 2 million U.S. jobs. Critics included a growing number of Trump supporters. The global economy is being taken down because of bad math, said billionaire Trump donor Bill Ackman. This is not what we voted for. Cracks also appeared among White House aides, with advisor Elon Musk calling for the tariffs to be softened and labeling Trump's pro-tariff trade advisor, Peter Navarro, dumber than a sack of bricks and truly a moron. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent cast the pause as part of Trump's master plan rather than a retreat. This was his strategy all along, said Bessent, adding that the pause was needed to craft bespoke deals with each country. No one creates leverage for himself like President Trump. Many in the media clearly missed the art of the deal, White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt told reporters. But Trump's trade representative, Jameson Greer, was unaware of the impending pause when it was announced. He was defending Trump's tariffs in front of the House Ways and Means Committee. It looks like your boss just pulled out the rug from under you, said Representative Stephen Horsford, the Democrat from Nevada. What the columnist said. Trump's lackeys can try to spin this however they want, said Steve Bannon in MSNBC.com, but calling it calculated is a joke. The president's breakneck reversal came just a day after Leavitt told reporters the president has a spine of steel and he will not break. Trump himself wrote days earlier, "My policies will never change." When you shift gears just days after vowing not to, it's hard to see this as anything but a retreat in the face of failure. "It's further evidence there was no coherent plan for this monumental policy shift," said Jim Garrity in National Review. "The administration slapped import duties on uninhabited islands and calculated reciprocal tariff rates, not by assessing the tariffs other countries actually put on U.S. goods, but rather by using a nonsensical formula that took our trade deficit with each country and divided it by the amount of goods we buy from them, and then cut that figure in half. Navarro insisted tariffs were not a negotiating tool, even as Trump said the opposite. Meanwhile, senior officials alternately cited mutually exclusive goals for the tariffs: to address trade imbalance, create negotiating leverage, raise revenue, and boost domestic manufacturing. "If there's a winner here, it's China," said Tom Rogan in the Washington Examiner. "Until now, the U.S. has counterbalanced China's growing power by offering wealthy nations a more appealing alternative: relatively free trade bound to relatively predictable governance and the rule of law. But the erratic Trump's on-off tariffs have turned the tables. For one-time U.S. allies desperate for any markets to replace the U.S., China now appears not as ideological adversary, but as an economic escape hatch. And Chinese President Xi Jinping is unlikely to miss the priceless opportunity Trump has given him." "Trump pulled the nation back from the abyss," said Nikki McCann Ramirez and Ryan Bort in Rolling Stone, "but the economy is still in a concerning state of flux. A substantial 10% universal tariff remains in effect, as does a 25% import tax on many foreign autos. Trump has said tariffs on lumber and pharmaceuticals are coming. Meanwhile, we're in a slowdown with China, with astronomical, a showdown with China, with astronomical 125% tariffs slapped on our third largest trade partner. And Trump keeps reversing himself with no apparent plan for how to resolve any of this." "And so the gargantuan trade war is back off for now," said Jonathan Chait in The Atlantic. After mocking Republicans spooked by the trade war as panickins, Trump a day later reportedly balked in the face of troubling shifts in the bond market and argued a possible full-scale financial crisis. Questioned by reporters, he said, "I saw last night where people were getting a little queasy. He may not be finished with his tariff war, but apparently there are lines even Trump still won't cross, and massive harm to his wealthiest supporters appears to be one of them." Controversy of the week: Doge. Have we passed peak Musk? "Money can buy a lot of things," said Allison Morrow in CNN.com. The $288 million Elon Musk spent on to help elect President Trump and other GOP candidates, for instance, secured him a job heading the previously non-existent Department of Government Efficiency, with apparent authority to fire 280,000 federal workers and shutter entire agencies. But money can't buy all things, as shown by the parade of humiliations Musk suffered in the space of 24 hours last week. First, Wisconsin voters rejected the conservative judge whom Musk spent $25 million trying to install on the state Supreme Court. Hours later, Tesla reported a 13% sales slump, its largest drop ever. Soon after, anonymous White House insiders told Politico that Musk had overstayed his welcome in Washington. And President Trump told his inner circle that Musk would soon be stepping back from Doge. Musk dismissed that report as fake news, said Aaron Blake in the Washington Post. And the White House issued a non-denial denial, saying Musk was always scheduled to step aside once his incredible work at Doge is complete. But with Republican lawmakers privately grumbling that they're paying the price for the Tesla CEO's high profile and personal unpopularity, voters dislike him by 60-38%, it's getting harder to deny that the Musk experiment looks like a political failure. Musk may be a liability, said Jonathan Swan in the New York Times, but White House sources say Trump has no intention of cutting ties. For a president who avoids blame at any cost, the deeply unpopular Musk is a useful heat shield who can absorb voter anger over Trump's anti-government rampage. Add Musk's unlimited resources, his promise to fund primary challenges against disloyal Republicans, and his ownership of X, the most important media channel in GOP politics, and there is far more upside than downside for Trump in keeping Musk close and engaged. I suspect we haven't seen peak Musk just yet, said Richard Waters in the Financial Times. Trump still needs Musk's money, and with Tesla in trouble, Musk needs his influence in the Oval Office more than ever. Democrats hope he sticks around, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. In the final days of the Wisconsin race, Musk wore a cheesehead hat and presented Wisconsin voters with oversized, legally dubious $1 million checks, only for his candidate to lose in a 10-point drubbing, exceeding every polling estimate. In the charisma-free Musk, Democrats may finally have found a Republican boogeyman who can drive their own voters to the polls while not turning out right-wingers at a similar clip. Some Republicans still think Musk is a net positive for the GOP, said Joe Lovinger in Bloomberg. Senator Ted Cruz this week described the White House's chaotic tariff debate as a battle of angels and demons and declared that the anti-tariff Elon is one of the angels. Why would he want to stay in Washington, asked Jeffrey Blehar in National Review. After last week, Musk can surely see the lesson of his failed political adventure, that most forms of genius are non-transferable, and that a figure of his authentic talents belongs in the private sector, building technology that dazzles and changes the world. That would be nice, said Richard L. Hasten in Slate, but the more likely lesson Musk and fellow billionaires will take from Wisconsin is that overt displays of money being converted to raw political power can backfire, and that they can distort and control our politics far more effectively by retreating into the shadows. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It's a good week for carnivores. After an op-ed in MIT Technology Review hailed recent advances in the development of bodyoids, brainless human bodies grown in artificial wombs that could supply transplant organs, be used in medical research, and provide meat or other products with no animal suffering. It was a good week for Russian exports after Washington Capitals captain Alex Ovechkin, 39, scored the 895th goal of his NHL career, breaking the record set by Canada's Wayne Gretzky in 1994. Russian President Vladimir Putin congratulated the Moscow-born Ovechkin on his momentous achievement. Pardon me there. It was also a good week for the pursuit of excellence after The Atlantic reported that Interior Secretary Doug Burgum has not only ordered political appointees to master the art of baking fresh cookies in the department's industrial ovens, but on at least one occasion has demanded subordinates remake the cookies because the batch was subpar. But it was a bad week for animal helpers after police arrested a Nevada man for keeping seven emotional support tigers at his ranch in Pahrump. They give me calmness, peace, said Big Cat owner Carl Mitchell, 71. The Americans with Disabilities Act does not recognize tigers as emotional support animals. It's a bad week for je ne sais quoi after claims in a new book that French President Emmanuel Macron of France wears industrial amounts of Dior's Eau Sauvage perfume to the point that Elysee staff can smell his approach before he enters a room. One former aide said Macron is aware of the effect and that it's a way of almost marking his territory. Finally, it was a bad week for supplemental income after Belgium's Prince Laurent lost a legal battle to claim Social Security benefits on top of his $430,000 a year state-provided royal allowance. Laurent, 61, said he was acting out of principle and not for the money. In other news, SCOTUS blocks rehiring of fired federal workers. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of the Trump administration this week and blocked a lower court's ruling ordering the government to rehire some 16,000 fired federal employees. The original lawsuit was filed by labor unions and nonprofit groups that said they were harmed by cuts to public services resulting from mass layoffs at the Pentagon, the Treasury, and the Agriculture, Energy, Veterans Affairs, and Interior Departments. But in a two-paragraph order, the High Court said those groups hadn't suffered an injury that granted them legal standing to sue. Liberal Justices Sonia Sotomayor and Ketanji Brown Jackson dissented, with Jackson saying the court shouldn't have to decide such a critical case through a rushed emergency application. The decision may have a limited impact, since another trial judge's ruling requiring the reinstatement of many of the same 16,000 workers remains in place. The briefing. When the U.S. invaded Canada. President Trump has talked of annexing our northern neighbor. We tried to do just that in the War of 1812. What sparked the war? American anger at the British, the former colonial overlords who at the time ruled Canada. The already strained relationship between Britain and the fledgling U.S. hit a boiling point in the early 19th century. Britain, embroiled in the Napoleonic Wars with France, put a blockade on American trade ships bound for mainland Europe, and it seized thousands of American seamen and conscripted them into its undermanned Royal Navy. There was another source of tension closer to home, British support of Native American tribes along the Great Lakes, who used British-supplied weapons in raids on U.S. settlements and inhibited Western expansion. With the rallying cry, Free Trade and Sailors' Rights, President James Madison made America's first declaration of war. Hopelessly outgunned by Britain's formidable navy, the Americans targeted Canada, figuring its conquest would humble Britain and grant leverage in wresting concessions. For at least some Americans, there was also another purpose in striking north. What was that motive? It's one that President Trump might understand. A lust for new territory. An incipient kind of manifest destiny drove many in the rural South and what was then the American West. The territory stretching up the Mississippi Basin to the Great Lakes, said University of Virginia historian John C.A. Stagg, and Canada seemed an easy target. It had a population of only 500,000, while the U.S. was home to 7.5 million, and Britain was busy battling France. Many Americans thought they'd be welcomed as liberators because a large share of those living in what is now Ontario were essentially Americans who had crossed the border because land was plentiful. says Canadian military historian Terry Kopp. Acquiring Canada, said former President Thomas Jefferson, will be a mere matter of marching. How'd that work out? Very badly. At the time, the U.S. Army was a ramshackle force of about 7,000 men, which included too many incompetent officers and too many raw, untrained recruits, said historian Donald R. Hickey, author of several books on the war. And the logistical challenges of fighting on a remote frontier were daunting, if not inseparable. The Americans launched a three-pronged invasion across the Detroit River and the Niagara River and at Lake Champlain, New York, but flopped at every juncture. In Detroit, U.S. General William Hull, who had confidently declared that residents of Canada would be emancipated from tyranny and oppression, surrendered to a much smaller force after falling for a bogus British document that warned of a vast approaching army of native warriors. Hull was later court-martialed for cowardice. By January 1813, the American campaign had yielded only disaster, defeat, disgrace, and ruin and death, said the Green Mountain Farmer, a Vermont newspaper. Did U.S. fortunes improve? Marginally. The Americans racked up a number of victories in 1813, including, surprisingly, in naval battles on the Great Lakes and in the Atlantic. It is a cruel mortification, said a cabinet member in London, to be beat by these second-hand Englishmen upon our own element. The Americans reclaimed Detroit and captured York, now Toronto, and burned several government buildings. But hampered by desertion, a lack of coordination, and deaths from disease, hunger, and exposure, the Americans made little other headway into Canada. Things took a turn for the worse in 1814, when the British sent some 4,500 battle-hardened reinforcements across the Atlantic. Landing in Maryland, they marched on Washington, D.C., and set fire to the President's house, not yet called the White House, the House and Senate chambers, the Library of Congress, and other buildings. The conflagration could be seen from 50 miles away. With the U.S. demoralized, nearing bankruptcy, and mired in what amounted to a stalemate, many Americans wanted peace. Most people understood that the USA would now be mainly on the defensive, and Canada was now beyond our reach, said Hickey. Meanwhile, the British were exhausted by more than a decade of war and eager to be done with it. How did the war end? With a treaty signed in Ghent, now part of Belgium, on Christmas Eve, 1814. It restored the pre-war northern boundaries with both sides surrendering conquered territory. Given that the British had seized big chunks of Michigan and the Great Lakes, it amounted to a pretty sweet deal for the U.S., said University of Virginia historian Alan Taylor. The maritime issues that had ignited the war weren't even mentioned in the treaty, and a major American victory was still to come. Unaware a peace deal had been struck, some 7,500 British troops marched on New Orleans on January 8, 1815. They were repelled by 5,000 defenders led by General Andrew Jackson, who became a national hero and in 1829 the 7th president. What was the war's legacy? It was an unhappy one for Native Americans along the frontier. Battered by the conflict, they lost their British backers and would soon be pushed aside by U.S. westward expansion. As for the primary combatants, both claimed victory. The Americans, buoyed by New Orleans and quick to forget the war's humiliations, celebrated their survival against a powerful foe. It unified the country with a new sense of national purpose, said American historian Walter Borneman. It also gave a nationalist boost to the Canadians, who'd repelled an attempted invasion and would gain nationhood in 1867. The 2012 bicentennial of the war was widely commemorated in Canada through museum exhibits and historical reenactments. It's a very defining moment for Canada, said Canadian military historian Mark Zulke. If those invasions had succeeded, we probably wouldn't exist. Time for a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. A measles epidemic is coming. We used to think of measles outbreaks in the U.S. as isolated events, said epidemiologist Michael Mina. Since the virus was declared eliminated here in 2000, outbreaks have mostly been short-lived and confined to communities with low vaccination rates. That hard-won public health triumph, made possible by decades of vaccination, is now unraveling. Vaccine skepticism has gone mainstream, fueled by fearmongers like our Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who continues to peddle the debunked claim that childhood shots cause autism. The surging outbreak in Texas, where at least two unvaccinated children have died of the disease, shows how fragile our defenses have become. Measles is wildly contagious. A single case can cause dozens more among the unvaccinated. Those infected can suffer pneumonia, brain inflammation, and permanent disability or death. Recent studies estimate more than 9 million children are vulnerable to measles, as are 3.6 million infants too young to get shots, and millions of immunocompromised Americans who can't safely receive the vaccine. The Texas outbreak is now above 500 cases, and that number could quickly rise into the tens of thousands. Each case is a spark, and the fuel is all around us. Let men have a place to be men. With President Trump restoring sanity to the federal definition of sex and gender, women-only spaces are once again being protected, said Inez Felcher-Stepman. But what about the guys? Men suffer when denied their single-sex spaces as well, and there are far fewer such bastions than there used to be. Starting in the 1990s, one all-male space after another fell to the twin demands of feminism and misapplied civil rights law. The Elks Club, that fixture of mid-century American life, was pressured into admitting women in 1995, and so was Virginia Military Institute a year later. Citadel after citadel fell, and now even the Boy Scouts have gone co-ed. The loss of these spaces has coincided with an alarming rise in male loneliness. One in four men younger than 30 now report having no close friends at all. And no wonder, with cultural messaging that treats masculinity as inherently dangerous, toxic, or backward-looking, the heroic male friendships once celebrated in literature, such as Frodo and Sam in The Lord of the Rings, are now sniggered at as bromances by a society that cannot take non-sexual male connections seriously. Women should get their own retreats, of course. Men, too, deserve a place of their own. This column comes from Ireland. Reject Trump's crusade against DEI. Donald Trump is dragging us into his war on woke, said the Irish Times. The U.S. president is urging every pressure tactic he can find to push America's main trading partners into dismantling their own diversity, equity, and inclusion policies, just as he has done at home. He's not just twisting our arms with tariffs. U.S. embassies across Europe have sent letters to companies that have commercial contracts with the U.S. government, telling them to cease immediately any DEI programs. The diktat from the U.S. State Department baldly claims that White House anti-DEI directives extend beyond America. The war on woke is a cornerstone of the worldview of Trump and his band of ultra-libertarian tech billionaires, headed by Elon Musk. In reality, there is an abundance of research that shows DEI programs are good for the economy and society. Broader access to jobs and education can foster collaboration and innovation while reducing economic inequality. But Ireland has another important reason to resist. Trump is America's duly elected leader, but nobody on this side of the Atlantic voted for him. He has no mandate here and no right to stick his nose into our domestic policy decisions. European nations, alone and collectively, owe it to their constituents to stand firm and tell Trump we won't let him tell us how to run our companies. And the last word, or feature article, a casualty of Doge. Joy Marver devoted her life to serving the U.S., said Eli Saslow in the New York Times. Then the government decided the disabled Iraq War veteran was no longer an essential employee. It had been 6 days since Joy Marver was locked out of her office at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, 5 days since she checked herself into a hospital for emergency psychiatric care, and 2 days since she sent a letter to her supervisors. Please, I'm so confused. Can you help me understand? Now she followed her wife into the storage room of their house outside Minneapolis, searching for answers no one would give her. A half dozen bins held the remnants of 22 years spent in service to the U.S. government, first as a sergeant first class in Iraq, then as a disabled veteran, and finally as a VA support specialist in logistics. She had devoted her career to a system that had always made sense to her, but now nobody seemed to know whether she had officially been laid off, or for how long, or why. Are you sure you never got an email? Asked her wife, Mickey Joe Carlson, 49. How would I know? Asked Marver, 45. They deleted my account. Maybe it's because you were still probationary. My boss said I was an exempt, Marver said. I was supposed to be essential. In the past couple months, more than 30,000 people across the country were fired by President Donald Trump's new initiative called the Department of Government Efficiency, a historic reduction of the federal workforce that has been all the more disruptive because of its chaotic execution. The VA said it planned to cut about 80,000 more jobs this year, including tens of thousands of veterans. And for Marver, the shock of losing her job was eclipsed by the disorientation of being repeatedly dismissed and belittled by the government she served. She had watched on TV as Trump's billionaire advisor, Elon Musk, took the stage at a political conference, wielding a chainsaw to the beat of rock music, slicing apart the air with what he called the chainsaw for bureaucracy. She had listened to Trump's aides and allies deride federal employees for being lazy, parasitic, unaccountable, and essentially wasting taxpayer money in their fake jobs. In Marver's case, that job had meant helping retrain soldiers for the civilian workforce and coordinating veteran burials while earning a salary of $53,000 a year. Here's the note I got a little while after I was hired, Marver told Carlson, pulling the form letter from the government. You represent the best of who we are as Americans, it read. You could have chosen to do anything with your talents, but you chose public service. Kind of boilerplate, but it's nice, Carlson said. Marver dug through the bins, pulling out military awards for exceptional achievement and tactical proficiency, and pushing aside a large steel hunk of a rocket. It had exploded on her base in Iraq during an attack in 2020, leaving her with a concussion, damaged eyesight, and a traumatic brain injury. She had come home flattened, depressed, and ill-equipped to hold a corporate job, but working alongside other veterans at the VA had done more to restore her sense of purpose than any of the five medications she was prescribed for post-traumatic stress disorder, panic attacks, and anxiety. She reached into another bin and pulled out her last performance evaluation from October. She read the reviews out loud to Carlson, looking for clues that might hint at a reason for her dismissal. Joy puts the mission first. Team player, responsible, continually displays professionalism. She is a great employee. She scanned down to her performance rating and saw that her boss had not circled satisfactory, or fully successful, or even excellent, but had instead chosen outstanding, the best possible result. I did everything they wanted me to do, Marva said. She flipped over the sheet and read it again, searching for some hidden flaw. You're not going to find anything that makes it add up, Carlson said. This was never about you. She kept American flags all over the house, raised above the front porch, framed on her bedroom wall, draped over the gun safe, and tattooed on her right biceps underneath the word loyalty. She had just turned 21 when she enlisted in the National Guard a few months after 9/11, and she had served under Republicans and Democrats for 2 decades without paying much attention to politics. Her job was to follow orders wherever they led, driving a Humvee that exploded when it hit a roadside bomb in Iraq, scrambling underneath her bed during rocket attacks, defending herself and others with a riot shield in downtown Minneapolis during the violent protest in the aftermath of George Floyd's murder. Her military career spanned 3 active duty tours and more than 800 days in war zones, and each year she was graded by her superiors based on a list of Army tenets she understood to be reciprocal. Loyalty, duty, respect, honor, integrity. Her final tour had been the most dangerous, most damaging, when she was stationed at Camp Taji outside Baghdad in March 2020 during a series of incoming rocket attacks that killed several soldiers. One day she heard more than 30 explosions on the base and started running through clouds of black smoke and into a bunker just as the rocket landed nearby. She felt the shock waves rip through her, clouding her vision and rattling her ribcage. She checked her arms, her shoulders, her legs. Her body remained intact. She stumbled into the middle of the bunker and told her soldier she was fine, but then she started vomiting, blacking out and slurring her words. A few hours later, she was diagnosed with a concussion and a traumatic brain injury, and doctors had been taking measure of her wounds ever since. She was rated 10% disabled for eyesight, 10% for hearing loss, 20% for back pain, 30% for persistent migraines, and 70% for depression, PTSD, insomnia, anxiety, and memory loss. I think I'm going to have another panic attack, she said one day about a week after her firing from the VA. It was almost 2 p.m. and she was still in her pajamas. Have you taken your medicine yet? Carlson asked. I've been trying not to, Marva said. Take it, Carlson said. Kick up the dose. Rockets. It was the word they used as a shorthand for all the accommodations Marva's new life required after she returned from Iraq. Her chronic fatigue and recurring nightmares? Rockets. Her sudden avoidance of crowds? Rockets. They had moved out of a noisy apartment building in downtown Minneapolis and into a suburb south of the city. They bought a house with soundproof walls, a canoe, and a view of the lake, but Marva still jolted awake and paced the bedroom at night. Carlson felt as if she was married to a new person, so she had started keeping a handwritten list of all the ways in which Marva was diminished by her last tour. Memory before Iraq, great, meticulous. After, forgets appointments, leaves lights on, misses entire strips when mowing the grass. Personality before Iraq. Does funny dances and makes up silly songs. Great social skills. After. Sense of humor gone and very introverted. Avoids big crowds or new places. She lost her spark. The difference is night and day. Relationship before Iraq. Happy. Normal. After. No intimacy. I am now more of a caretaker than a wife. The next afternoon, they drove out of the suburbs and back into Minneapolis to see Marver's psychiatrist at the VA. The hospital was across the street from the administrative building where Marver used to work, and she pulled up to her old entry gate and tried to look inside. "I'm getting the same panicky feeling I had that morning," Marver said. "Relax," Carlson said. "Breathe." "I couldn't control any of my thoughts," Marver said. She pulled back onto the road, but now her mind was stuck inside the confusion of that last morning at work when she was locked out of her computer as her colleagues began arriving for work. Her manager said that there had been a mistake and that he would sort it out. She waited at her desk until another manager came back and said he was sorry, but her name no longer existed in the system. He asked for her badge and walked her outside. She sat in the cab of her truck in the parking lot, staring at the wheel. She didn't want to go home. She was tired of disappointing Carlson with bad news, tired of being the problem. She started the engine and drove out of the parking lot. She stopped at a traffic light that led onto a bridge. She knew a half dozen veterans who had died by suicide, including two of her closest friends in Iraq, and she sat at the red light and considered it for the first time. If she proceeded onto the bridge, if she swung the wheel to the right, if she pressed down on the accelerator and drove over the guardrail, the light turned green. Her hands were shaking. She didn't move. Someone honked from behind, and for a moment it jarred her back. She drove across the bridge, parked at the VA hospital, and followed signs to the psychiatry department. Now she was arriving there again for a follow-up appointment. She held Carlson's hand in the waiting room until a psychiatrist came to greet them. "You might have saved my life that day," Marver told her psychiatrist. "I felt this voice telling me, do it, just get it over with. It came on so fast it scared the shit out of me." "I'm so glad you had the courage to get help," she told Marver. "How are you doing today?" "I'm stable, but it's dark," Marver said. "I can't turn off the news. Nothing that's happening makes sense. They keep getting rid of things without even knowing what they're cutting." She said she was worried about layoffs affecting the doctor she relied on at the VA, the specialist who treated her traumatic brain injury, the neurologist who managed her migraines, the therapist with whom she relived the rocket attacks, and the psychiatrist who rushed out of a meeting to see Marver as soon as she crossed the bridge, consoling and hugging her until she finally stopped shaking. She changed back into her pajamas. She took medication for a migraine. She went back to bed and slept through the afternoon until Carlson came home from work. "Rockets," Carlson said. "You can't stay like this forever. Get up. Get mad. Get back in the fight." A former colleague had invited Marver to speak at a town hall in southern Minnesota alongside a few other fired federal workers, and at the last minute Marver agreed to go. She waited in line for her 5-minute slot and then stared out at the crowd of about 100 people, trying to find the right words. "Sorry," she said into the microphone. "This is hard for me." She scanned the audience for Carlson, who raised her fist in support. "Okay," Marver said, let's try this." She told the story of her firing, the ensuing confusion, and her crisis at the hospital. "Is this how we treat our veterans?" she asked. On the ride home, she could still feel the adrenaline and anger rising into her chest. She stopped on the front porch and reached up for the flag. She smoothed out the fabric and rehung it upside down. "You're sure about that?" Carlson asked. "Until this country starts making sense again," Marver said. She kept watching the news and checking her email for a reasonable explanation. More than a week after she was fired, Marver received a termination letter from Human Resources. "Your performance has not met the burden to demonstrate further employment," it read. She received another message a week later. "The VA is rescinding the termination," it read. "You will be on administrative leave. You are not to return to duty at this time." And then, 24 days after she was fired, she got another email with a subject line marked urgent. return to duty instructions. The message told her to report back to work Monday morning. "Are you kidding me?" Marva said. She searched for more information online and saw that a federal judge had ordered the government to rehire some probationary employees, ruling that their mass firing was based on sham reasoning. The Trump administration had agreed to comply with the order, even as it filed an appeal to the Supreme Court. "Who knows what they'll tell me tomorrow, Marva said when she showed the email to Carlson. "Why even go back there again?" Carlson asked. "Because I can keep helping veterans," Marva said. A version of this article first appeared in the New York Times. One of the health and science pieces. Implant turns thought to instant speech. 2 decades ago, Ann Johnson lost the ability to speak after a paralyzing stroke left her with quadriplegia. But the former school teacher now has a voice again, thanks to a pioneering brain implant. Johnson, 47, recently underwent surgery to have a brain-computer interface, a BCI, a paper-thin rectangle containing 253 electrodes placed on the surface of her motor cortex, the part of the brain that controls physical movement. Researchers then used the device to record Johnson's brain waves as she silently read from a list of words and phrases such as, "Hey, how are you?" An AI model translated those bursts of neural activity into 80 millisecond segments, equivalent to about half a syllable, which a synthesizer turned into an audible speech based on voice recordings of Johnson from before the stroke. "It's a streaming approach," co-author Gopala Amachupalli from the University of California, Berkeley, tells NBCNews.com. "The system is not waiting for a sentence to finish. It's processing it on the fly." While BCIs for speech already exist, most have a short delay between the internal thought and the computerized verbalization, disrupting the flow of conversation and leading to frustration and misunderstandings. The research, funded in part by the National Institutes of Health, is still in an experimental phase. But with sustained investment, he says it could potentially be available for patients within a decade. And on the Talking Points page, the resistance, is it finally taking off? "You can stop asking where the mass opposition is," said Tim Murphy and Mother Jones. "It's everywhere." Hundreds of thousands of people protested against the Trump administration last week at a nationwide action called Hands Off. Organized by an array of progressive groups, the rallies were held in major cities and small towns alike, across all 50 states. Manhattan's march stretched nearly 20 blocks, while in tiny Madras, Oregon, a town that President Trump won by 30 points last year, over 100 people gathered. Demonstrators carried signs denouncing Elon Musk, Trump's tariffs, the threat to Social Security, and the assault on the rule of law. "Turd Reich, no," read one poster. "Down with Doge bags," proclaimed another. It's refreshing to see Americans rise up, given that there wasn't a mass protest after Trump's second inauguration to rival the women's march that took place after his first. Resignation seemed to reign as politicians and business leaders bowed and scraped. But these marches have punctured that delusion, offering an unavoidable illustration of outrage. These ho-hum protests starred the usual suspects, white liberals trumpeting pet causes, said Noah Rothman in National Review. Rather than joining in, newly outraged Trump voters may find themselves unnerved by the alternative to Trumpian chaos. Some protesters, for example, waved Palestinian flags and yelled about Israel, which probably seemed quite beside the point to someone worried about their 401k. Still, maybe Democrats don't need to evolve. They could win a chance at power simply because Republicans blew theirs. Yet there's also a different kind of anti-Trump resistance brewing, said Micah L. Sifry in the New York Times. It won't come from politicians, even if Senator Cory Booker made a heroic effort with his stirring 25-hour anti-Trump speech last week. Instead, keep an eye on federal workers. They're largely moderates, and almost 30% are veterans. By firing them en masse, Trump is radicalizing the very people who can't explain what we all lose by eviscerating government services. Now Democrats need to drive home that message, said Joel Lawrence in the Bulwark, by offering a program of renewal that taps into the anger and longing to once again be the respect-worthy America. Trump's actions are hurting everyone from veterans to retirees to business owners and students. There are millions of Americans coping with illness or job loss, millions passionate about science or education or the Constitution or the law, all the things Trumpism is destroying. Reach them, and you have a movement. Loomer, feeding Trump's paranoia. An unhinged conspiracy monger now calls the shots on U.S. national security, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic. Laura Loomer is a far-right celebrity who describes herself as a proud Islamophobe, claims 9/11 was an inside job, and said a Kamala Harris White House would smell like curry. She has no official role in the Trump administration, and even ardent Trump loyalists call her toxic. But what she does have is Trump's ear. So when she sat down last week for a meeting in the Oval Office, armed with a list of National Security Council officials she considered disloyal neocons, Trump seemingly listened. The next day, at least six staffers were fired, followed by General Timothy Hall, the National Security Agency, and the U.S. Cyber Command Chief. Trump denied Loomer's role, but if she truly had nothing to do with it, the timing of their meeting is one hell of a coincidence. Loomer was happy to take credit, said Josh Meyer in USA Today. She thanked Trump for acting on her advice about Hall and vowed to expose more officials with questionable loyalty. Loomer's influence is supposed to be shocking, but there's nothing surprising about it, said Issy Lepowski in Vanity Fair. Trump himself is a conspiracy theorist who has embraced political paranoia relentlessly for decades, and Loomer knows what matters to him. Trump can abide almost any malfeasance in his backers. Sexual assault allegations against Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth don't matter to the president, for example. But being charged, even in Loomer's kangaroo court, with something less than total fealty is a non-starter. Trump admits he's not a trusting person, and that breeds a voracious appetite for stories of nefarious plots hiding in plain sight. Loomer whispering about turncoats whets that appetite. Trump should be careful about surrounding himself with sycophants, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. His first-term advisors were willing to challenge his isolationist impulses, and those debates yielded good results, as when a U.S. drone strike killed Iranian General Qasem Soleimani in 2020. Loomer's favored Abandon the World faction would never have had the wisdom to pull that off. Instead, they could drive Trump into a bad nuclear deal with Tehran, a weak peace agreement in Ukraine, and a failure to deter China from attacking Taiwan. There are real-world consequences to purges like this. Who will risk giving Trump candid counsel if they're going to be tossed out at the urging of an online mob? And a few of the short notes. Wealthy Americans ages 50 and over have roughly the same chance of dying over a 12-year period as their poorest peers in Northern and Western Europe, according to a new study. Researchers said the high mortality rate among rich Americans is likely a result of lifestyle issues, such as poor diet, lack of exercise, and loneliness. A group of barren islands near Antarctica, covered in ice and home only to penguins, was swept up in President Trump's trade war last week and hit with a 10% tariff. That import duties were slapped on Australia's Heard and McDonnell Islands suggests this was a rushed process, said Australian Trade Minister Don Farrell. The Social Security Administration is reducing its workforce from 57,000 to about 50,000, the lowest level in decades, even as record numbers of baby boomers age into the program. As a result of cuts and changes already imposed, hours-long wait times at the agency's field offices and on phone lines are now routine. The agency's computer network has crashed at least 10 times over the past 6 weeks. The Department of Agriculture's Research Science Division has issued a memo banning the use of keywords and phrases including climate, vulnerable, greenhouse gas emissions, and safe drinking water. Also prohibited are sustainable construction, diesel, solar energy, runoff, and microplastics. And we will finish out the show today with two quotes. Both have to do with children. Frederick Douglass, quoted in The Telegraph, says, "It is easier to build strong children than to repair broken men." And writer Catherine Schultz has a cheeky quote. "The collective noun for toddler is super spreader." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.